It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strangechamps. Every so often, something happens that is so unusual, so inexplicable, it feels like a sign. As if the universe is trying to tell you something, or prepare you for something.
I spend a lot of time walking in the parks on lots of different trails with my dog and also just by myself.
Heather Swan is a writer, a teacher, and a friend. She had this amazing and mysterious encounter with an owl recently, not too far from where Steve and I live. So they got together for a walk in the woods, and she told him the story.
I was walking one night and saw an adult barred owl and was absolutely stunned because I hadn't ever really seen one as close as this. I felt like I had been sort of pierced by this gaze. I started walking sort of night after night at around dusk. One night, I heard this sound, and it was so unlike any other sound that I usually heard in the woods. It was sort of like, psh, psh. And I thought, what is that sound? And so I walked toward it, and I saw this juvenile owl. I was just so excited. Then one afternoon, I was sitting in my yard, and I looked up, and about 10 feet in front of my chair was an owl looking straight at me. My heart is actually beating right now when I think about that moment. I looked up and just stared at this owl, and then in a few moments, she flew away. Later in the evening, as it started to get dark, this owl kept returning to my yard. I was transfixed. She kept returning. She knew that I was there. She became very comfortable with me and would land quite close to me. I would say that it sounds probably crazy to suggest that an owl was visiting me. But by the end of 3 weeks, having the experience of her landing right next to me when I was standing by my gate made me think there is some connection here that I don't understand, that I felt so privileged to have. They can have a wingspan of something like 38 to 48 inches. They're really big. A good friend of mine said, you have to be careful. You're going to get sliced by the knife-like talons on this creature. But I was never afraid, even when, like, one time she was on a branch that was probably, I don't know, 9 feet in the air or something like that, and I was on the ground, and she came down, and she flew right past my face. Her wings actually brushed against my face and my neck, and she landed right in front of me. I could have gotten hurt, but she never, there's never anything aggressive about it. One day I climbed up into the tree where I had seen her frequently, and she came and she flew and she landed next to me, and it was as though why is it, has it taken you so long to get up here? Like, what are you doing on the ground all the time if you can get in this tree? I think that probably had I been maybe even in a different space in my life, I might have been afraid, but I wasn't afraid. So at that time, I noticed that my friend John Hitchcock was posting a lot of prints that he was doing. He's an amazing silkscreen artist who is Comanche and Kiowa in his ancestry. And his work is mostly about the wisdom of his ancestors. He had owls in his prints suddenly. So I wrote to him and I said, "Hey, John, what's up with the owls?" And he wrote back and he said, "My family would say it might mean that the eldest member of your family is going to die if it's a screech owl." And I thought to myself, oh, good, it's not a screech owl. I said, oh, well, geez, maybe I should be a little bit nervous about the owls. And he said, oh, you know, they're messengers. The owls are messengers of big change. A week later, my dad died.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Was that unexpected?
It's funny. He was struggling with Parkinson's disease for a long time. He was choosing not to live in a 24-hour care facility. And with Parkinson's, at his stage, he was falling a lot. So we knew that there was the possibility that he would fall. And he did. We brought my dad to a care facility. He didn't want any kind of intervention. No, you know, no morphine, no drugs at all, no machines. And so I realized that the kind of patience that it took for me to be with this owl, the kind of bringing down of my own ego, was exactly the energy that I needed to have with my dad when he was transitioning out of this world and into the next one, whatever that is. So anyway, I wrote to John and I said, "Hey, John, the eldest member of my family did die." And he was not surprised by that. He told me the story about his grandfather dying, and they knew that he was at the end of his life because owls started visiting the house. And when the owls came, his grandmother started singing the prayers, and soon enough, his grandfather had moved on. What was astonishing to me about John's story was how comfortable he was with that, that his tradition supported that knowledge. And I felt like I wished I'd had a tradition like that to sort of lean on, but I didn't. And he felt like it was okay for me to accept that story. I struggled with it afterwards. Is that a tradition that I can borrow? Can I imagine that an owl was visiting me to tell me that my dad was going to die? Probably not, but maybe. I don't know if this owl knew anything, but I also can't say for certain that that owl did not recognize me, did not feel that for some reason I was needing this visit. And for John, it was so clear. Of course that owl was visiting me because my father was going to die. Yeah.
What happened to the owl? Did the owl then leave?
I saw that owl only one more time after my dad died. And what was incredible was that she didn't come to the yard. She came to a tree that was a little bit further up the hill from where I lived. I had to hike up to see her. And she called to me one last time and then flew out of my life. And I never saw her again. And I am still working on imagining what that means exactly. But I think that one of the things about being with this owl had to do with, like I said, kind of bringing my ego down and trusting something that was sort of bigger than me. I was afraid of my dad leaving this world. I was not really, no one is ever ready for it. I think, you know, we all experience death. We all will face our own deaths, but we don't talk about it very well in this culture. A lot of times we have very sterile environments and hospitals, and we have machines and all of that. So I think that my experience with this owl did help me to allow something without trying to intervene, without trying to ask for something specific. And I really tried with my dad to be in this sort of, strangely, in a similar space of witnessing and not trying to control, but rather to honor what he needed and to be there with just this sort of openness and just love. And I did actually try to approach that owl with love.
Do you feel like you think about death in a different way now because of this experience?
You know, I think that we all have this sort of, this energy, an individual energy, whether it's an owl or a bee or a human. For anyone who's been with someone who's dying, it's so strange when the life actually leaves the body. But you know that that individual was not just a physical being. And if you don't have a strong faith tradition that explains this, it's complicated. You think, where did this person go, right? For me, the experience that I've had with being in the natural world, you know, being with my dad in that really sacred moment, has made me really feel like he's transformed into something that I don't understand. But I don't think he's gone. I don't imagine that, like, he's sitting here with us right now in the way that maybe some people believe. And I admire that if they do. But for me, it's much more that his existence has not disappeared. It's only changed into a much sort of larger kind of existence. And that, I guess, is something that I believe came in part from experiencing this comfort from this visiting creature. Whether or not that was connected in my life, that happened. And I am so grateful for that.
I love that story. That was Heather Swan talking with Steve Paulson. She also wrote about that experience in an essay called What the Owls Knew. And if you like bees, check out her first book, Where the Honeybees Thrive, Stories from the Field. So I wanted to begin this episode with that story, because I've been thinking a lot about death and grief. So many people died during the pandemic, 4.8 million and counting. And whether we notice it or not, we're in a global period of mourning. But some cultures are better prepared to handle it than others.
My grandmother was, I think we would describe her as a character, and I lived with her when I was in university.
This is Gillian O'Brien. Her grandmother was Irish.
She was someone who was obsessed with death, but not in a particularly morbid way. She would happily discuss death and funerals and her own funeral, and in some ways was looking forward to it. And she certainly planned her funeral right down to the finest detail, and was very determined that she would get to choose what she would wear when she was laid out for her wake. She wanted to be laid out in a dress that she'd had made in 1975 for one of her son's weddings. And I said that it was A, out of fashion. B, she was a much smaller woman. C, it was total madness. And D, most importantly for me at the time, it was taking up room in my wardrobe, in my room in her house. And I said, well, look, you'll be dead and you won't get to choose. 2 nights later, I came home and parked the car. I went in and there was no sign of her. And she called me down from her bedroom. She had literally laid herself out as a corpse, complete with rosary beads entwined in her fingers. She had low lights. She was out lying on top of the covering with her feet pointed to the ceiling, and everything about her looked as if she was a corpse, apart from her eyes slowly opening and saying, what do you think? Well, I didn't have a camera, so there is no photo, but I think I insisted she get up. But the one thing she did decide was I was right. The dress really didn't fit. And so the dress then disappeared, presumably to a charity shop. But it is not what she was laid out in when she did eventually die. She enjoyed that story about her laying herself out because all of my college friends knew that story. And she was very much a character in their lives too. But when she did die, she was laid out in the clothes she bought for her 90th birthday. She had spent quite a lot of money on. She was a woman who didn't have very much money, but she did like fashion.
Just because you have to die doesn't mean you can't enjoy your own funeral. Lessons from the Irish, next. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. When it comes to remembering the dead, no one does it quite like the Irish.
Everybody turns up to a funeral in Ireland, and you go as much for the living as the dead. So you don't have to know the person who's died. You just need to know somebody who will be sad that they have died, and you go to show your support for the living. Unless it's a tragic death, it really is done with sort of verve and enthusiasm. But I've enjoyed myself at funerals more than at many weddings.
Gillian O'Brien grew up in Ireland, so she's been to lots of funerals. She's also an historian, and so she's very familiar with Ireland's long history of trauma and collective grief. And Gillian thinks a lot about how we remember loss, especially on a mass scale. A few years back, she set out on a dark tour of her country's many historic sites and memorials of death. Her book, The Darkness Echoing, Exploring Ireland's Places of Famine, Death, and Rebellion, came out during the pandemic, which seems weirdly appropriate. So I was thinking that a dark tour might be just what we could all use right now. We've survived something terrible, we're itching to travel, but we still collectively need to mourn. Just be warned, if your dark tour is anything like Gillian's, it could take longer than you think.
I planned it as quite a short little jaunt around the country, sort of stopping off at prison museums or museums associated with the famine or emigration. And I genuinely thought I could do it in a couple of months. And 2 years later, I was still on the road. Because you just meet people and they'd say, oh, but have you been to? Oh, you really should go there. And then you'd go off there and someone else would tell you to go another 2 miles down the road to all these small little museums. you know, at the end of a night of traveling, I'd go into the local pub and you'd end up sitting around talking about funerals and death and the tragedy of the local area or things. It sounds very miserable, but I really enjoyed a huge amount of my travels around the country. And I was a little bit sad when they ended.
Right. Well, tell me about one particular piece of history, the Great Famine. I guess in the US, we call it the Irish Potato Famine. For a long time, that wasn't even written about by historians, right?
Well, that's the really interesting thing. I mean, for a century, there was no academic textbook written in Ireland about that period. And still in Ireland, there aren't that many museums about the famine. And when you do start to look into the detail, you find that, you know, there's awful tragic stories, local stories of where neighbours turn upon neighbours and family turn upon themselves. And I think for more than a century, it was just too painful because those that survived may well have known those that died and may have overlooked them or may not have shared their food. And I think there were just really raw, difficult wounds that you couldn't make light of. And there was no levity in, and that sort of tragedy, it took us a century before we really were prepared to investigate.
It's hard with mass trauma on that scale. You know, I think the human mind can't really take in the numbers. It's been hard during the pandemic, for instance, to find ways to even comprehend what 2,000 deaths a day means. That must be true of the Great Famine, too.
I think that's really significant. I think a million means nothing. I don't know what a million is. I can't conceive what a million people could possibly be. One of the big problems telling these sort of stories is that so many of the people affected by the famine are the poor. And we don't have very many artifacts because poor people didn't have things. And it's really hard to tell the story of the famine without having things to show. But I remember finding or seeing a tiny shard of a mirror in a museum in County Roscommon. And it comes with a list of what a community of 4,000 people had. And they had almost nothing, but they had this one shard of mirror between them. And I remember thinking, those people had no need of a mirror. That's the sort of a thing you have with vanity and with having clothes to change and makeup to put on and hairbrushes to comb your hair. They had no need of any of that because they had nothing. They were a real subsistence economy. And they're the people who were absolutely devastated by the famine because there was no safety net for them. And seeing that mirror was something that just really stuck in my head because it's a tiny piece. It's set in a little wooden frame, but it's the size of the palm of your hand.
Wow.
There's something really moving, I think, about that in a way that you could give me all sorts of figures and they wouldn't emotionally connect.
Are there even any records? I imagine there aren't even many names or dates or anything.
What we don't have in a lot of cases is we don't know the names of people who died and people who were buried in mass graves because people were dying. There's one graveyard in Skibbereen in County Cork where they're estimated to be 9,000 people buried in this famine plot. And people were dying at such a rate and they were being buried very quickly because there was a fear of infection from them. Mm. And we just do not have names of all of those people. So we will never know the full number of people who died during the famine period.
Wow. So out of all of the historic sites connected with the famine that you visited, you mentioned the mirror, but are there any other, I mean, what's one place that you think, wow, they really did a good job?
For me, it's not so much the museums because there are so few artifacts, but for me, it's the graveyards. And there's one little tiny memorial in the west of Ireland in County Mayo, and it's just a little cross. It marks this walk that people did from this small village called Lewisburg, where they walked 12 miles to meet the Poor Law Guardians. And these were the people who made decisions about whether people would get extra relief or food. And when they got there, they were told they had to wait outside while the Poor Law Guardians ate their lunch, which is just to me, the cruelty of that, to do that to starving people.
Yeah.
And then when they'd eaten their lunch, the guardians came out and said, no, we'll give you nothing. And so they had to walk back up this road. It's a road in the west of Ireland, which on a good day, it is absolutely beautiful. You've got hills on both sides, you've got a beautiful lake. It's amazing and it's also heartbreaking because many people died on that walk back up to Lewisburg, to the town. And that one little cross where I always pull in when I'm going down the road towards Delphi, that I find is the most moving thing about the famine. That, and often there were these public works that were done where people built pointless things. So there were walls, stone walls built across the west of Ireland that had no purpose other than to give work to those who needed it. And it's those sort of things that really I find terribly moving.
In their anonymity, really.
It's like the landscape of loss. But unless you know about it, you would just drive on.
Did it begin to get to you psychologically at all? It's a lot of sights of suffering.
It certainly made me very reflective about a lot of things and made me think about what sort of funeral I would like and to give a lot of orders about, you know, following my grandmother's footsteps. But I do think that because almost everywhere I went, I either went with friends or I went and talked to people afterwards. So I definitely decompressed after days, but I did need to do that. I could have written a very somber book, but I thought, well, nobody will read that if it's just pages of misery. So I wanted there to be levity in the book and humour and occasionally jokes.
Yes, it's very Irish of you.
Thank you. I'll take that as a compliment.
Yes, I liked it. There's such contradictory feelings about visiting any places like this. And I was thinking, I was remembering visiting New York City and staying in a hotel just opposite the 9/11 memorial, the site of the Twin Towers. And I had to kind of gear myself up to visit it. You know, I mean, I was there on vacation, but visiting the 9/11 memorial is not like going to MoMA. You don't go for pleasure or for entertainment. And so why go? Out of a sense of social responsibility, to bear witness? Why? Why do we go and why does it matter that we go?
Yeah, I think you make a really interesting point and it's something I think about quite a lot because that is part of dark tourism. And I think there's a spectrum of darkness. So going to something like that memorial, and you notice it's the same, I think, with concentration camps. Why do people go to those sites, which are absolutely heartbreaking? You know, one of the things that I remember when that memorial opened and there was a lot of discussion about what they would sell in the shop. And I think you can tell a lot about a dark tourist site by, are they selling things that are educational and is it books about it or are they selling things that are exploitative or tacky? I mean, it's still very recent, 9/11. And is it as a memorial for those who died and their families or who is it aimed at?
Yeah. I don't know if I would have, if I'd been staying all the way across town, I don't know whether I would have gone all the way across town on purpose to the 9/11 memorial. But, you know, staying in a hotel, looking out the window on the site, I had to go. Maybe what I'm saying is I think sometimes these are sacred sites.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to think of a sacred site as something good, but tragedy can make a site sacred.
Yeah, I think that is important. You know, when you're standing in that area, it's an area where thousands of people died. And I think to take a moment to note that is really important. I think it's important that people are remembered. That's all we've got really left. One of the things I love most in the world is going around old graveyards and reading the names of people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I would never know. And what it says maybe about what their job was or what children they had.
I feel exactly the same way about graveyards. Even if I don't know who this person was, all I have is the name and some dates. The fact that I'm taking a few minutes in my life today to just try to think about them, wonder who they were. That feels like some tiny, small gift I can put out into the world.
I completely agree. And I think there's something that's really hard to articulate about that, that I think it is emotional. It's funny because loads of people don't talk about how much they like graveyards. And as soon as I say, you know, my favorite thing in the world is a graveyard and to walk around and look at the names and think about, oh, look, a Victorian graveyard and look at all the names that you no longer hear. Or look, this name is now fashionable again.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things, the amount of people that kind of go, oh, actually, I really like doing that too. I just never tell anyone. I'm like, oh, you should. There's lots of us out there.
Oh, yeah. And just piecing together bits of history, especially at a family plot, and beginning to see, you know, who died when. And you can see, for instance, waves of disease come through. A terrible flu season, or wait, that was the 1918 flu, or a diphtheria epidemic, or whatever. That's, it's all fascinating.
I would do that anytime I go to somewhere I don't know, because if I go to, say, a local graveyard in Liverpool, you can see the amount of them that are shipping merchants or traders. And that's when Liverpool was, you know, that's how it got its wealth. It's my top tip for anyone going to visit anywhere is start with the cemeteries, start with the dead, and then work towards the living.
Oh, I love that. Thank you so much. I was going to ask at the end of this, what lessons do you have for us? Things to think about when setting out on a dark tour of your own?
Well, I think identify a pub to go to at the end of the day, because you might need it depending on what your dark tourist site is. But I do think always start, even if it's not a tourist site, it start with the graveyards and be prepared to find that there is levity in doing some of the dark tourism sites, not the ones that are the darkest. But I think it's a really good way of, you know, we always look at the shiny things and the bright stuff. And that's certainly how we would like to portray everything. But there's real merit, I think, in looking at the other stories. And also in any museum, go and sort of look beyond the main cases. I always find the things that are more moving are the little things sort of stashed away in the back that you can sort of learn something about a person rather than, as you said earlier, stories about the million, because the million mean nothing to us. We have to find the people.
Mm. Thank you so much for your advice. You make me long to have this pandemic end so we can get out and visit places again.
Oh, I know. I really miss being able to get into museums and out on sites. I'm hoping it happens soon.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much for talking today.
You're very welcome.
That's historian Gillian O'Brien. We talked just before St. Patrick's Day. Her book is The Darkness Echoing, Exploring Ireland's Places of Famine, Death, and Rebellion. You know, one increasingly popular way to remember someone who's died is on your skin, with a memorial tattoo. Tattoo artists say it can be up to 20 to 30% of their business.
Where do you want me?
Land your back with your head there.
Okay. Oh, yeah, of course.
On our staff, Charles Monroe Kane has the most ink, and he just got his first memorial tattoo.
Is that right?
Yeah. Cool. It was only a few years back. My older brother Joe and his best friend Doug completed a dream. They rode their Harleys from Maine to the North Pole. As they rode back, unfortunately, my brother had a freak accident in Anchorage. He was killed.
Ready?
Yeah. It was one horrible experience after another.
Oh yeah, it hurt.
The worst was telling my mom that her son was dead.
You okay so far?
Yeah. You didn't tell me it was gonna hurt. My brother fit the Harley bill to a T. He was big, he was bald, he had a beard down to his stomach. A number of people in his life got memorial tattoos. You know, the Harley logo with his birth and death dates. Live to ride, ride to live. But I didn't see him that way. Sure, he was a badass, don't get me wrong, but he also was my roommate for the first 12 years of my life. He taught me how to ride a bike. He gave me terrible advice about girls.
This guy sounds like somebody I would be, like, madly in love with.
Yeah, he also was, like, very quiet, very angry, mm-hmm. and very bad. So he, as my wife would say, he'd be the perfect guy in high school to, like, I can fix him. My brother had the top bunk. and he decorated the area with album covers. Ozzy, Alice Cooper,
Iron Maiden,
yeah,
Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd.
But right above his bed, he had a mirror, a Joe Cool mirror,
that he won at the Ohio State Fair. It was, I don't know, you know, 8 by 8 inches, with Snoopy on it. Snoopy was wearing a red Joe Cool t-shirt. I thought that mirror was cool as hell.
And then I remember that. Oh, that's right. I'm going to get that.
Did you guys both get it at the fair together, or was it just...
Not like, just him. It was just kind of thing that he got, brought it home. It was the only thing that wasn't an album cover.
Yeah.
On May 21st, 2020, just past midnight, at the beginning of the pandemic, Joe's daughter Chelsea had a baby boy. His name was Bodie. Bodie just had his first birthday the other day. Time heals wounds. But when Chelsea had Bodie, some of my wounds just, I don't know, they reopened. I mean, goddamn, he would have loved being a grandfather. And it wasn't just that. I mean, I really struggled during the pandemic. I could have used his advice, especially with my kids. He was a wise man and he was a good father.
Are you pumped?
Yes. Yeah, because of...
Doesn't that look nice?
Yeah, it's great.
I like the juxtaposition.
I am too.
So I decided to get a memorial tattoo to my brother, Snoopy. Joe Cool. I'm looking forward to showing it to Bodie someday. Tell him stories about his grandpa. Rest in peace, Joe Cool. I miss you, brother.
That's Charles Monroe Kane, getting his first memorial tattoo at Wayward Tattoo Studios by Gabe Joyner. If you want, you can see a picture of it on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, doctor and poet Rafael Campo talks about treating and remembering his COVID-19 patients. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. This is the sound of a ventilator. And for Dr. Rafael Campo, it's been the soundtrack of the pandemic.
The Doctor's Song. The ventilators rise and fall. The ambulance's siren call. The blue gowns rustle down the hall. They page us and we go. The wail of loved ones. Silence then. Until the next alarm. A pulsatile bleat. Almost like an infant's cry. A team in baggy scrubs slogs by. The coughing like a symphony a virus might conduct. We listen as if the breath sounds might not lessen as if the body we are given protected us. The stethoscope won't be an instrument of hope. It merely amplifies the gallop, makes audible the failing heart. The doctor's song is not heroic. Sing like the needle. Sing like hurt.
Rafael Campo is familiar with epidemics. He started practicing medicine at the height of the AIDS-HIV crisis, and he's been on the front lines of COVID-19 at Harvard Medical School and at Boston's Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He is also an award-winning poet, one of those rare hybrid physician poets who sees medicine and writing as different modes of healing. Shannon Henry Kleiber reached him in between patients.
So, Rafael, how are you? How are you doing right now with being a doctor through this entire pandemic?
You know, of course, it's been such a challenging time for so many of us. And I think for me as a doc and for other doctors, it's been particularly cruel because the pandemic and the isolation and distancing that it has imposed on all of us has really alienated us in many ways from our patients and kept us more than 6 feet away in settings like the ICU, even in the clinic where I spend most of my time caring for patients. We're masked, we're gowned, we're removed from the presence of one another in ways that I think really can interfere with empathetic care, the kind of care that I think is so important. I have to say that my connection to poetry and through poetry to my patients has really probably been the most sustaining thing in my life as I've continued to work with folks who are ill with COVID-19 infection.
I read that you're writing poems for those who have lost their voices in a literal sense, those who've died, which I thought is so powerful. Is that your way of grieving?
Yes, you know, that is one way I think poetry helps us. And probably the oldest poems that we know were elegies, were expressions of grief. We're called to grieve through language. And that language allows us, poetic language in particular, allows us to create a kind of container for our grief, or if not a container, a way of making sense of our grief. Death comes for all of us. And poetry, again, I think, makes some kind of sense of it by narrating it, at least, I think helps ease our own pain as we confront death.
Were there many poems written after other times of great death and illness?
Yes, absolutely so. And I think of the AIDS pandemic, and I remember so clearly when I was training to become a doctor, I was an intern and a resident at the University of California in San Francisco at the height of the crisis. And I remember activists in the street chanting, "Silence equals death, silence equals death." And those voices, the poems that came out of that moment, actually were sustaining, I think, in a very real sense. Not only did they help us bear witness to, you know, the tremendous suffering in communities that were most impacted by HIV and AIDS, but also I think they actually spurred scientific research that led to some of the medicines that we have now that are so effective in treating the infection. And that poetry, I think, really saved lives. In some, I think, very real sense, saved my own life. That was life-sustaining for me.
Tell me more. How did it save your own life?
Well, you know, I felt so hopeless then as a gay man and member of the Latinx communities, two communities that were particularly impacted by HIV and AIDS. I felt, you know, that it could be me. And that hopelessness was really dangerous. And so discovering voices and engaging with those voices helped me think about what I might do to be a healer, to stay on this path of becoming a doctor and not give up, not allow this dread disease to take me too. And so in that sense, it really did save my life, that language. And it also, I think, helped me really to become a better doctor. It really helped me retain my or preserve my humanity as a doctor.
It seems like we have a lot of deferred grief that's happening right now. And I lost someone early on from COVID, my best friend's mother, who was really my best, my second mom growing up. And I just feel like I haven't seen her for a long time. And I haven't seen my friend for a long time either. And I just haven't grieved.
It's interesting what you say, Shannon, about, you know, that sense of a kind of deferred grief, because so often we can't be present with our loved ones when they're facing the end of life because of the fear of contagion, and that sort of immediacy is lost. So I think poetry for me is a way of revisiting in a way those lost moments, or projecting myself imaginatively into those moments where one can still, I think, create a sense of connection and allow oneself to feel what wasn't allowed in that actual moment. It also goes back to what elegy does since the beginning of human history. It enlivens, it brings back the lost loved one in a way that's really almost alchemical. And the person that we've lost in some ways, I think, lives again.
When you felt despondent during this time, do you sit down and write a poem, or how does it work? Do you say, maybe try, and it makes you feel a little better even if the poem doesn't come right away?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I'm so exhausted, I can't actually write.
Yeah.
But, you know, I find that these experiences, being in the clinic with patients, is itself like being inside a poem in so many ways. And so the poems are being written sort of all the time as I'm present with my patients. So when I do finally, you know, have, I don't know, 10 minutes to sit down and usually late at night, and I'm not so exhausted that I can't keep my eyes open, I feel compelled to write, to prepare myself for the next day. And writing is healing. I almost can't resist. I can't imagine not writing. I think of the two things that I do as really inextricably interrelated. I can't imagine doing one without the other.
You're giving some of these patients more voice, or a voice that they otherwise won't have.
Yeah. I mean, I hope I am able to do that. I don't want to ever, you know, in a sort of glib or presumptuous way, say, oh, I know this other person's experience and I can articulate it for them. But I definitely, at the same time, have a sense that, you know, how many patients of mine have been really literally silenced by that endotracheal tube being placed through the vocal cords when they go on a ventilator. And so who is there to speak to their pain, who can be a witness to that suffering?
I wanted to ask you to read Vaccination. And if you could also just tell me first a little bit about when you wrote this, and if anything kind of got you to think about writing this poem.
Yeah, this is actually a very, very recent poem. And it was inspired actually by the story of one of my patients whose sister actually was dying of COVID. And he said to me, you know, he just wanted to see her in the ICU. And the doctors said it was impossible. He couldn't see her. You know, she was dying essentially alone in the ICU. And he said, I just wanted to smash the glass wall. I could see into the ICU, but I couldn't see my sister. I couldn't visit her. So that resonated with some of my own experiences in caring for patients and feeling, you know, that distance and wanting to get through it. So this is a poem, again, just wrote it a couple of weeks ago. Vaccination. Immunity, supposedly, through pain. I see their faces like I'm there again. The ICU, its brightness crystalline, controlled fragility. I want to smash the panes of glass, break through, tear off my mask. Somewhere, The nurse's station, maybe. Bach plays, like a memory, like someone dying, like viruses artfully multiplying. I still remember how hard I was trying to not let one more die. But it was AIDS back then, and so instead we busily made quilts. Dreams, supposedly, or grief, betrayed us to ourselves and let us hope again. I see their faces and I'm there. Their pain is mirrored in the sink's metallic drain as once again I wash my hands, my eyes above my mask, same blur I recognize. Immunity, elusive, still contrives to make us think we might live long enough to find the cure. Across my latex gloves, his skin feels alien, but still craves touch, at least as I imagine it. So keen this interplay of notes, the major key and minor fall, the prick of the vaccine.
Wow, that's really beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
And you feel like you're there. I mean, you just kind of brought me right into that spot. I feel like I could hear it and see it.
Oh, well, if that happened, then I think that's what poetry can do for all of us is, you know, bring us into that space where we can't, we're told we can't go in, we can't go into the ICU, but yet we can. And I think poetry helps us transcend those distances and those barriers.
Physician poet Rafael Campo. He's written 5 award-winning poetry collections and 2 nonfiction books, The Poetry of Healing and The Healing Art. He practices medicine at Harvard Medical School and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and he was talking with Shannon Henry Kleiber. You know, I think we haven't really acknowledged how many people lost someone they loved during the pandemic. Partly because there weren't a lot of opportunities to mourn together. We couldn't hold funerals or go to memorial services. We couldn't even hug each other. And that's why we wanted to do this show. To remind all of us that even though we may not notice it, we're living in a time of mourning. And maybe the kindest thing we can do for each other right now is to talk about it. So thank you for listening. Be well.